I am very excited about what I would say is the growing collaboration between CEOs and their management teams and thinking about how to make the board real partners in running the company, making sure it's successful, and that partnership being not always agreeing, but a healthy level of challenging skepticism, but also coaching and support.
From McKinsey & Company, I'm Sean Brown, and welcome to Inside the Strategy Room. You just heard our senior partner, Celia Huber, reflecting on the changing dynamic that she's seeing develop between corporate boards and their top management teams. Celia leads our North American board services practice, and in today's episode, she's joined by fellow senior partners Michael Bershon and Andy West, the global co-leaders of our strategy and corporate finance practice. Celia, Michael, and Andy recently sat down to speak in New York following a client CEO event. Their discussion touched on how CEOs and CFOs can better manage their relationship with the board, how to shape the composition of the board so that it can respond most effectively to the accelerating rate of change in geopolitics and technology, as well as best practices for bringing newer perspectives into the boardroom. We hope you enjoy the discussion. It's the first in a series of conversations that Michael and Andy will hold with our thought leaders across the practice. Now here's Michael to start us off.
Certainly one of the things that I'm excited about is the dynamic between CEOs and their boards. And when I spend time with my clients right now, that is quite often a topic of conversation. How do I manage the relationship with my board? How do I give them the confidence to enable me to be bold, right? I don't want to preside over slow decline. I want to be courageous, and I need the sort of permission space from the board to do that. Even, by the way, CFOs saying, look, how, as a CFO, certainly in Europe or in the UK, for example, they're often on the board themselves. How do I interact with my board colleagues?
And I think managing through uncertainty has been a really big theme. And Celia, you should talk a little bit about CFO's role on the board, because a lot of them found that to be an interesting opportunity to kind of frame who they are, frame the agenda. But I also felt like just this sense of how do I manage, allocate resources, reallocate resources in a time when I am unsure about what has to happen. So I need to broaden the balance sheet. I need to retrench to provide some flexibility for investment. And yet I also have to facilitate the organization through reinvesting in times of change when we're unsure about how things are evolving.
Well, I think, as you guys know, I focus primarily on North American boards. And I do think the European context is somewhat different. But I think in both cases, the focus of the CFO being very, very important, not just to brief the audit committee, but almost as an independent, direct to the board, understand their fiduciary duty, partner to the board, has become more and more important given the uncertainty. I mean, we had a bunch of conversations today with CEOs that talked about just the cash situation during a particular crisis and being able to manage well for that. And that is a board level issue, right? And it can be an existential issue if you haven't planned for it. So look, I think I am very excited about what I would say is the growing collaboration between CEOs and their management teams and thinking about how to make the board real partners in running the company, making sure it's successful, and that partnership being not always agreeing, but healthy level of challenging skepticism, but also coaching and support.
And actually, I'd love your perspective on something that I've been hearing clients ask about a bunch, right? So often to get on a board, right, you have had a storied professional career, right? As many years of service, and then you end up on a board. And at least, you know, one or two of my clients have been saying about, hang on, what we need to navigate going forwards is probably somewhat different from, you know, before, right? Or the technology of the next 10 years is very different from the technology of the last 30. Or, you know, we were in a geopolitically calm world and now we're in a sort of more tense world. What do you see about, you know, bringing more diverse or newer perspectives onto boards? Is that happening?
Yeah, I think that is happening. It's certainly happening from what I can see for larger companies in the US. The composition has changed, I would say, in two ways. One, more understanding of bringing different expertise to bear. So folks who've been in the military, folks who've been in government, people who are active CIOs in their current job or active C-suite level executives, rather than thinking about the retired CEO as the primary person.
Right.
I think the second thing that's changed is just a notion of, hey, the world is changing. And so someone who's been retired for 20 years may not be exactly the right person to have on my board. And so the combination of thinking through the orchestra, not just a single player, right? So how do I put all those instruments together so I get more contemporary expertise and yet not lose the, I've been a storied CEO and really understand that.
So look, on this idea of contemporary expertise, this concept of both the change that's going to be engendered by generative AI, the concept of digital capabilities as an asset, a currency, right? Much like cash, right? In a given organization, or data being a relevant asset for an organization. How is that affecting the dialogue in boards? Because you're right, they tend to be older. They tend to be a bit more experienced, right? And the world is a fundamentally different place.
Well, look, I would say that every board member has an obligation to educate themselves on what's happening in the industry, what's happening in technology. And you'll see in many of the sessions that we run for board members, they're very interested in understanding more about AI, and they're interested in understanding it from a variety of sources. So they're not just listening to what management has said about their use of AI. They're actually craving that knowledge from a bunch of different sources and triangulating what they should be asking their management team about. And I think what you find is the board members who are really excellent are constantly picking up new areas of expertise and educating themselves, whether it be the SEC's new regulations or what's happening on climate change or what's happening with AI, cybersecurity, and asking the management team to dedicate more time in the board meetings to those.
Celia, again, I'd be interested in your take on this. I recently was invited to speak at a private equity firm's, you know, offsite. So they brought all the CEOs and chairs of their portfolio companies. And we were talking about CEO excellence. We got to the role of the board. And what a bunch of them were saying was, you know, they are much happier with the smaller board, right? Few people who can really get together and drive the company forwards. And of course, public company boards tend to be larger, right? And more disparate. I mean, do you have any thought about either the right size or how to make a large board effective? Because they were kind of skeptical it could be done.
Well, first of all, when you deal with private companies versus public companies, there is a difference in the expectations of the board members. So let's set that aside. I think those expectations sometimes make a smaller board more helpful. Mm-hmm. Then for a public company, you know, you want to make sure that you're hitting the level of composition that you need. So I might argue if you get too small, it's hard, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what are you going to do? I've got, you know, five people on the board. How am I going to get
the
diversity,
of
expertise and background? So I would say what we're seeing a lot of folks end up at is kind of 10 to 12, because it feels like enough to get the composition that they want, but not so much that is unwieldy. Now, there are a whole bunch of institutions that at times have boards of 20 to 30. In fact, particularly in healthcare, right? Hospital boards sometimes are that size. And I think it's really important to think about what you gain by having that size, which makes it more of an audience than a dialogue. It's more of a presentation than a discussion, and how to get back to something that can work, you know, even in that size. Maybe it's more committee time, things like that. But in general, I would say the sweet spot seems to be about 10 to 12.
One thing, Celia, just to change gears a little bit, talking about kind of uncertainty and the board's role, bringing terms of diversity and breadth and talking about different issues, you know, it strikes me one of my favorite things to do, right, is every day I look at the news and I look at all of the news on macro and I look at what's happening in the markets and all of the headlines. And certainly it is a is a topic. When I actually go and spend time with senior executives and talk about how that actually affects their strategy in a specific way. So yes, interest rates are going up, but does that fundamentally change how you compete? Or some, yes, if you have a high degree of bridge financing and you're trying to build hydrogen infrastructure, and or you're an early stage biotech and you don't have an eye on cash, so you need short-term financing to fund your operations, big impact. But on average, for big companies, how are they talking about kind of macro volatility at the board level? And what's the right way for boards to interject their kind of wisdom and long-term view and breadth on management?
Well, there's definitely a wrong way to do it, which is I read an article this morning, and now I want to know what you're doing about Silicon Valley big tech entering our space. And, you know, I have seen a lot of boards get dysfunctional because one person can't let, it's been asked and answered, and they can't let go that, you know, a big technology player is going to disintermediate them completely. Okay, so if you said, okay, don't bring a single issue, but you want to take the totality of issues right. that you see, I do think boards are doing much better on things like geopolitical risk, which countries, what is our supply chain? I think they understand that. Some of the risks on cyber have been well documented as well, so they understand that too, privacy. But I think some of the new risks that are coming out, I mean, AI model hallucinations, right?
Yeah.
Those are questions that are not yet really fully in the boardroom. And I think you will start to see those there. So I do think folks are very aware of what's happening in the world. But I also hear CEOs that say, hey, if I'm going to announce bad news, I make sure my board sees it coming. So that they don't, yeah. they're not surprised. And so I do think it's two-way. So we've been talking about the board bringing those issues to management, but I think it's also management proactively raising the issues to the board.
I think it's interesting, actually, the, you know, in our CEO excellence research that some of our colleagues have done, they were talking about how, with respect to the boards, radical transparency is, you know, sort of the policy. And what they were, I thought was interesting was when they were reflecting that it was the best CEOs who were very comfortable with that.
Right.
And the CEOs with a less strong track record were much more nervous about that sort of notion. And it was almost that that confidence to be radically transparent with your board was sort of a marker of someone who's likely to do the CEO job well.
One other topic that seems to be on the mind of a lot of organizations and a lot of senior executives right now is the actual composition of their company portfolio. So it's just been a very hot topic, not uncommon, right, in terms of times of change when you have to pivot, you have a lot of exogenous shocks, you need to now change your business model to adapt to those shocks, whether it's integrating your supply chain, changing market exposure. Celia, you mentioned kind of geopolitics and it being big in the boardroom. And this whole concept of how do you do this? How do you do it quickly? How do you do it quickly in an uncertain environment? I think it's just a really interesting topic. And I'm sure it's sitting in the boardroom on a regular at a regular basis. Have you seen kind of an uptick in either the board's desire to get engaged on the business portfolio itself or play a heavier hand in either accelerating M&A, which is, you know, kind of at an all-time low, at least in the last 10 or 20 years, or accelerate divestitures, right, which haven't actually slowed?
So I do think board members, especially for public companies, think a lot about what an activist would do.
Yeah.
And if I take that lens, what would an activist do if they were running the company I'm associated with? And that does bring up portfolio shaping. I mean, portfolio shaping is really a board level conversation, right? Because we're not talking, if you really weren't shaping the portfolio, you're not talking about a 2% acquisition. You're talking about 30% or a spinoff, right? And so at that level, the boards are very, very deeply involved, including, I think, sometimes committees that do deeper work. And or a way that the management team might set up here, if these things happen, here kind of the moves I would like to make in our portfolio.
We do a ton of research, right? And there's a lot of interesting things I think are going to be coming out on some of these biases, right? We call it strategy to action. And I think the board's role in helping these biases not freeze management decision-making. So things like recency bias, you know, I kind of manage in the way that I've managed over the last 5 or 10 years. The board can bring a fresh perspective there, or some of this sunflower bias where everyone kind of does what the CEO wants. I mean, the board's role is a counterpoint. And I think these biases really slow down portfolio rotation. And I think when you look at data over medium to long periods of time, I continue to be fascinated that portfolios aren't rotating faster. I mean, they really are not, and despite all the activism and everything else. So it's interesting to me. I think that could be a major unlock kind of going forward for being a challenger, providing, especially with all of the uncertainty, providing a bit of a challenging role to management to help kind of protect them from, you know, their instincts.
Celia, maybe to change tack, right? When I've been involved in board recruitment, right, for some of the nonprofits I'm involved with, right, one of the questions often that come when you see sort of qualified candidates is, you know, but they've never been on a board before, right? Will they know what it's like to be, for example, a non-executive? And so almost, you know, getting your first board role is probably the hardest thing. And then if you do well, you know, you get others. And I know you spend a bunch of time and you run some programs and things to help folks move to board roles. I mean, what's your advice or your take for that first step?
Yeah, so I think there is a tension between having contemporary expertise on your board and having experienced board members. Most people who are board qualified do interact with boards. It's not like they've been in a vacuum, right? They interact with their own board. They may be on nonprofits where they interact with boards. And so I think the question really is, what is this person going to be like in the boardroom? And don't give me your operating resume. Give me how you think about the big issues that would be in the boardroom. So M&A, CEO succession, you know, and those types of questions, a lot of folks who've never been board members have pretty good barometers for. Mm-hmm. And the question is just trying to suss those out. I think there are a lot more people who are board ready than are board members.
Right. Well said. Yeah.
With many thanks to Celia, Michael, and Andy for taking the time to share their insights with us today. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us. We'd welcome your feedback and ideas for future podcasts. All you need to do is email us at itsr@mckinsey.com. That stands for Inside the Strategy Room. You can also share your ratings and reviews on any podcast player, with many thanks to everyone who's already done so. We really appreciate all of your comments and feedback and encourage you to please keep them coming. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to subscribe, you can follow our weekly series on any podcast player, where you can also access our entire library of previous episodes. We also offer an Inside the Strategy Room podcast collection page available at mckinsey.com/ITSR. There you can easily browse our prior podcasts across 6 major themes and also access written transcripts of all of those conversations. Finally, if you'd like to automatically receive our latest publications and insights, we encourage you to sign up for email alerts on our insights page at mckinsey.com or connect with us on LinkedIn at the McKinsey Strategy and Corporate Finance Practice page. Thanks again for listening. We look forward to having you join us again next week inside the Strategy Room.